Hello, and welcome to the Bible Made Easy podcast. I'm your host, Kelly, and I'm here to help you understand what you just read in the Bible. Hello, everyone. I am so glad you're on this journey with me. If you are new, welcome. If you have any questions on how the podcast is laid out, you can listen to my introduction episode. And everyone is welcome to go to my website, beamepodcast.com, to drop me a note, ask any question, or just get up to date on the podcast with the resources I have there, including links to all of my pop culture references. We'll be starting week 38a, Daniel chapters 10 through 12. The rest of the reading we had for the week will be covered in 38b. It's just there's so much information for Daniel that it needed its own episode. So let's get right into it and start in Daniel chapter 10. So you meet up with Daniel again, where he is very upset and troubled by the vision that he had. He was so upset that he was mourning and not eating. Many scholars believe that Daniel was also mourning because Ezra and the other Israelites had gone back to Jerusalem. Of course, Daniel would be 84 at the time and wouldn't have gone, but he also was more useful in his political position to them than going back with them. So while all this is going on, Daniel is walking outside and boom, this incredible man, unlike any on earth, came to him. And while only Daniel could see him, the others were so scared by what they couldn't see, but certainly felt, that they fled. This man, which some say sound like Jesus, but after the description and the man saying he needed the angel Michael's help, points to the fact it was not Jesus, but a very high-ranked angel. And Daniel fell to the ground. I mean, I think it's remarkable he didn't have a heart attack, considering how depleted he was emotionally, mentally, and physically, so we'll give it to him. But not only does he fall to the ground, but the hand lifts him up and gives him strength and tells him that he, Daniel, is highly esteemed. Now, coming from a high-ranked angel, that is just a wow there. Then the angel begins to explain to Daniel that God had sent his answer 3 weeks ago when Daniel was in prayer, but because he was opposed by the prince, which in this case would be an evil angelic being, otherwise a demon, was trying to stop him from delivering the answer to Daniel. And Michael had to come and help him so that this angel could deliver the word, which shows that our fight is not against flesh and blood, but by spiritual darkness. But we'll get more into that when we come to that verse. But suffice it to say, even when it seems your prayer is not being answered, keep praying. And not only did the angel have help, but once he gave Daniel the message, he had to go back and continue to fight against the prince of Persia and then of Greece. There is a spiritual battle going on. It hasn't ended, and in fact, it's only getting stronger. We also learn that Michael is the angelic guardian of Israel. So diving into chapter 11, please excuse any mispronunciations. I tried very hard to make sure that I was pronouncing these names correctly, but if I do it wrong, my deepest apologies. I mean, no offense. So in chapter 11, we learn that this was the answer that the angel was delivering. We learn about the four kings. They were Cambyses II, who was from 530 to 522 BC, Gaumata the Magian, Darius the Great, and Xerxes. Gaumata the Magian and Darius the Great were from 522 to 486, and Xerxes was from 486 to 465 BC. And the fourth king, Xerxes, would arouse his old kingdom against Greece. Kelly, side note, we will learn more about Xerxes personally when we get to Esther, but also know he was the king in the movie 300 going against Sparta. So you kind of have an already idea of what he was like. Then we learn about the king who will rise, but his kingdom will be broken into four areas, like points on a compass. On September 28th, 480 BC, the Grecian city of Salamis defeated Xerxes. This gave rise to the Grecian Empire, and more importantly, we meet Alexander the Great, who conquered the world at that time. When he died unexpectedly at the age of 32, he didn't have any heirs, so his kingdom was given to his four generals. So to the west, which is Greece, we have General Cassander. In the east, which was Asia Minor, we have General Lysimachus. In the north, which would be Syria, Babylon, we have General Seleucus. And then in the south, which is Egypt and the Holy Land, we have General Ptolemy. After years of fighting, the east and the west are absorbed into the north and south's kingdom. So for the rest of the chapter, the northern kingdom is known as Seleucid, and the Syrian kingdom and the southern kingdom are the Ptolemy people, which is the Egyptian kingdom. Now, in Daniel chapter 11, from here on out, I have information that comes directly from the notes of my pastor who shared with me, and I really appreciate that, and all the credit goes to him. Again, any errors are not on his part, but on my part for not understanding the material or not reading it correctly, so I deeply apologize to him as he's incredible. So, we're going to dive right into it. We are going to be reading the scripture and then explaining that scripture part.
And Daniel 11:5-9 prophesies a specific peace treaty between the Seleucids, the northern kingdom, and the Ptolemies, the southern kingdom, involving the daughter of the king of the south. And the verse states, "The king of the south will grow powerful, but one of his commanders will grow more powerful and will rule a kingdom greater than his. After some years, they will form an alliance, and the daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to seal the agreement. She will not retain power, and his strength will not endure. She will be given up, together with her entourage, her father, and the one who supported her during those times. In the place of the king of the south, one from her family will rise up, come against the army, and enter the fortress of the king of the north. He will take action against them and triumph. He will take even their gods captive to Egypt, with their metal images and their precious articles of silver and gold. For some years he will stay away from the king of the north, who will enter the kingdom of the king of the south, and then return to his own land." So let's get into it. In 249 BC, the king of the south, Ptolemy II of Philadelphus, sent his daughter Berenice to the king of the north, Antiochus II, or Theos. His plan was to stop the war that was raging between them and unite the two kingdoms through their marriage. Unfortunately, this plan had a flaw. Antiochus II was already married. However, because he knew his marriage to Ptolemy II's daughter would ensure peace and allow him to regain most of the Syrian possessions his father had lost to the king of the south, Antiochus II put away his wife, Laodice, and married Berenice. She persuaded him to reject Laodice's children and set her own to succeed him on the throne. However, after Ptolemy II died in 246 BC, Antiochus II repudiated his marriage to Berenice and left her and their infant son to return to Laodice. Doubting his faithfulness, Laodice quickly murdered Antiochus II with poison. She then convinced her son, Seleucus II, or Callinicus, to kill both Berenice and her son. So just as the prophecy said would happen, Ptolemy II, the king of the south, his daughter Berenice, and Antiochus II, king of the north, all lost in their struggle for power, which you can go back and read in Daniel 11:6. To allow for an easy following of the rest of Daniel 11:7-12:1, the subsequent commentary and historical analysis of Daniel 11 is taken directly from a blog called Here a Little, There a Little, and I would encourage you to pay particularly close attention to the explanation given regarding Daniel 11:36-39, usually interpreted in a futuristic manner and believed to be a prophecy of the coming Antichrist. The following commentary will clearly show this portion of Daniel's prophecy to be an accurate prediction of the life and reign of King Herod the Great. The only one who can foretell the future is God, and after a careful perusal of this chapter, never again should a believer ever doubt that God is the ultimate author of the Holy Bible. Pay close attention to the detailed prophecies and their fulfillment, and you will be able to answer any person who questions you about the authenticity of God's word. From Daniel 11:7, the verse says, "But from a branch of her roots, one shall rise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them, prevail." Ptolemy III, or Euergetes, the eldest son of Ptolemy II and the brother of Berenice, was not happy about the murder of his sister. He immediately invaded the Seleucid Empire. His armies defeated the forces of the new king of the north, Seleucus II, who was the son of Antiochus II and Laodice. His campaign was successful, and his armies achieved victory from the Tigris River to the coasts of the Asia Minor. Ptolemy III captured and put to death Laodice. He was even able to enter Seleucia, the port city on the Tigris River, and the capital, Antioch, and leave a garrison there. Daniel 11:8, "And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north." During the Third Syrian War, King of the South Ptolemy III is credited with recovering many of the sacred statues that the Persian forces of Cambyses had carried off during the conquest of Egypt some 300 years earlier. Because of this, he was known as Euergetes, or benefactor. Ptolemy III acquired much gold and silver during his victorious campaign, and in fact, from Seleucia alone, he received 1,500 talents of silver annually as tribute, about 10% of his annual income, and he outlived Seleucus II, who died after falling from his horse by 4 or 5 years around 222 BC. Daniel 11:9 says, "Also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land." So in 240 BC, the king of the north, Seleucus II, attempted to invade Egypt in response to the humiliation he had suffered at the hands of Ptolemy III. However, he had to return in defeat after his fleet perished in a storm. Daniel 11:10 verse says, "However, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife." So in history, the sons of Seleucus II were Seleucus III, or Kronos, meaning thunder, and Antioch III, the Great. Seleucus III, the eldest son of Seleucus II, began a war against the Egyptian provinces in Asia Minor. However, he was unsuccessful and was assassinated by members of his army in Asia Minor in 223 BC. Seleucus II's younger son, Antiochus III, took the throne at the age of 18 after his brother's death. From 219 to 218 BC, Antiochus III victoriously went through Judea, coming almost to the borders of Egypt. The verse Daniel 11:11 says, "And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemies." So in history, Antiochus III met with Ptolemy IV, the Philippator, at the Battle of Raphia, also known as the Battle of Gaza, in 217 BC. Antiochus III, the king of the north, had 62,000 infantry, 6,000 cavalry, and 103 war elephants. But the forces of Ptolemy IV, king of the south, were victorious in the battle. Antiochus III was forced to withdraw into Lebanon. Verse 11:12 says, "When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail." After his victory over Antiochus III, Ptolemy IV spent only 3 months settling affairs in the Holy Land before heading back to Alexandria. He was apparently eager to return to his luxurious and decadent life in Egypt. In his haste to go home, Ptolemy IV left the important port of Cilicia in Pyrrha on the Phoenician coast, which his father had first captured, in the hands of Antiochus III. After his victory at Gaza, the Egyptian troops trained to fight the Seleucids began a successful guerrilla campaign against his rule in Egypt. By the end of Ptolemy IV's reign, they had achieved independence in the southern part of Egypt. Daniel 11:14 says, "Now in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also, violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fail." In history, Antiochus III negotiated an alliance with King Philip V of Macedonia to divide up Egypt's Asian possessions. After some temporary setbacks, particularly at Gaza, Antiochus III's army inflicted a crushing defeat to the Ptolemaic forces about 199 BC at Peneus near the headwaters of the Jordan River. Regarding the prophesied action of the Jews, the Jewish historian Josephus wrote, "Yet was it not long afterward when Antiochus overcame Scopas in a battle fought at the fountains of Jordan and destroyed a great part of his army. But afterward, when Antiochus subdued those cities of Celesyria which Scopas had gotten into his possession, and Samaria with them, the Jews of their own accord went over to him and received him into the city and gave plentiful provision to all his army and to his elephants and readily assisted him when he besieged the garrison which was in the citadel of Jerusalem." Unfortunately, this Jewish assistance was not to be remembered when Antiochus IV later came against Jerusalem. Daniel 11:15 says, "Then the king in the north shall come and throw up siege works and take a well-fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not stand, or even his best troops, for there shall be no strength to stand." In history, following his defeat at Peneus, Scopas fled to the fortified port city of Sidon. But after Antiochus III besieged it, Scopas surrendered in 199 BC in exchange for safe passage out of the city back to Egypt. He and his troops were allowed to leave the city naked after giving up their weapons. Daniel 11:16 says, "But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him. He shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power." In history, with his final victory over Scopas at Sidon, Antiochus the Great took the Holy Land away from the Egyptians for good. Judea and Jerusalem had passed from the king of the south to the king of the north. Daniel 11:17 writes, "He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him." So the way this happened in history was young Ptolemy V had entered into a treaty with Antiochus III after his military was defeated in the Fifth Syrian War. Through this treaty, Antiochus III tried to strengthen his position and expand his empire further. Ptolemy V surrendered his Asian holdings to the king of the north and accepted Antiochus III's daughter, Cleopatra I, as a bride. They were married in 104 BC. Through this marriage, Antiochus III sought to gain a foothold in Egypt itself through his daughter, but his plan backfired. Cleopatra was a true wife of Ptolemy V, standing by him instead of seeking to benefit her father. Cleopatra was beloved by the Egyptian people for her loyalty to her husband. Daniel 11:18 says, "After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him." So how it happened in history was in 192 BC, the ambitious Antiochus III crossed into Greece to aid the Aetolians. He sent ambassadors to Rome asking for friendship. However, the Roman Senate replied that they would be friends if Antiochus III left the Greeks in Asia free and independent and even kept away from Europe. Antiochus III refused and went to war against Rome. With 10,000 men, Antiochus III sailed across the Aegean Sea and took some strongholds in Asia Minor. But in doing so, he alienated his former ally, Macedonia, King Philip V. The Roman army entered Asia Minor and defeated the large forces of Antiochus III at the Battle of Magnesia in 190 BC. In the peace treaty of Apamea in 188 BC, Roman general Publius Scipio set a high cost on Antiochus III for peace. He demanded 20 hostages, including his son Antiochus IV, a reduction of naval ships to 12, and payment to Rome for the cost of the war, totaling 15,000 talents over the next 12 years. The all-consuming ambition of Antiochus III had finally brought defeat to the Kingdom of the North. Whew, what a mouthful. Okay, in verse Daniel 11:19, "Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found." So in history, as a consequence of the Roman victory over Antiochus III, the outlying provinces of the Seleucid Empire again reasserted their independence. With his kingdom now reduced to Syria, Mesopotamia, and western Iran, Antiochus III was in dire need of funds with which to pay Rome for the cost of the war. In 187 BC, while attempting to plunder a pagan temple in Babylon near Sushan, Antiochus III was murdered. Verses Daniel 11:20, "His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he will be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle." So in history, Antiochus III's eldest son, Seleucus IV, Philippator, took over after his father's death. Due to the heavy debt burden imposed by Rome, he was forced to seek an ambition taxation policy on his shrunken empire. This included heavy taxation on the people of Israel. In fact, Seleucus IV even sent his treasurer, Heliodorus, to the temple in Jerusalem to extract money. The Roman Senate decided to trade hostages. Therefore, they ordered Seleucus IV to send his son, Demetrius, the heir to the throne, to Rome. In return, the Romans released Seleucus IV's younger brother, Antiochus IV. When released, Antiochus IV went to Athens. In 175 BC, after Demetrius had been sent away to Rome, Seleucus IV was poisoned by his minister, Heliodorus. Some historians think that Heliodorus desired the throne for himself, while others believe that Antiochus IV was behind the murder. Seleucus's young son, another Antiochus, age 5, was put on the throne in his place. However, Heliodorus was the actual power behind the throne. Daniel 11:21, it says, "And in his place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue." With Seleucus IV dead, the rightful heir to the throne was young Demetrius. However, he was no longer available, having been sent to Rome as a hostage. At the time of the murder, Antiochus IV was in Athens. However, when he heard of his brother's death, he quickly sailed to Pergamum. Once there, he sought the help of Eumenes II, the king of Pergamum. By flattering Eumenes II and his brother, Attalus, he received their support and backing. Antiochus IV arrived in Seleucia with a powerful ally and thwarted Heliodorus' design on the throne. He became co-regent and protector of Seleucus IV's infant son, also named Antiochus, in 170 BC. The younger Antiochus was murdered while Antiochus IV was conveniently absent, paving the way for him to take solo possession of the throne. Good grief. Whoever says history is boring has clearly never read anything. Okay, verse 1122. "With the force of a flood, they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant." Because of his ability to charm people and ally himself with them, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, God manifest, was able to overcome all threats to his throne. The Prince of the Covenant here is in reference to the Jewish high priest Onias III. He was the high priest at the time that Antiochus IV came to the throne. A brother of Onias named Joshua, who had become Hellenized and changed his name to Jason, made a deal with Antiochus IV. Jason told him that he would pay Antiochus IV a large bribe if he would remove Onias and make him high priest in his place. So Antiochus IV forced Onias out and installed his brother Jason as high priest in Jerusalem in 174 BC. In 172 BC, which is just 2 years later, Jason sent a priest named Menelaus to Antiochus IV with his tribute money. However, Menelaus took Jason's money, added some of his own to it, and bribed Antiochus IV to secure the priesthood for himself. Menelaus then returned to Jerusalem and deposed Jason, who fled for his life. Antiochus IV's double cross of Jason shows the true nature of his character. Verse 11:23. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. So, once again, the king of the north sets his sights on the kingdom of the south. In Egypt, the 14-year-old Ptolemy VI, the Philometer, had become king. He was the nephew of Antiochus IV. His mother, Cleopatra, was Antiochus IV's sister. Antiochus IV sought an alliance with Ptolemy VI, seeking to take advantage of what he perceived as weakness in the Ptolemaic kingdom and gain Egypt for himself. He moved through Syria and Judea into Egypt with a small army so as not to arouse suspicions to his true motive and seized Egypt. His cover story was that he was coming to act as the, quote, protector of his nephew Ptolemy VI. Daniel 11:24. He shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. So, Antiochus IV pursued a novel plan for gaining the Egyptian-controlled provinces. He moved into the parts of the kingdom that were the richest, and he did something that no other Seleucid king had ever done. Antiochus IV spread around some of the spoils from his war campaigns to secure the loyalty of the people. The historical book of the First Maccabees states that he spent much on the public. It is even reported that he would go into the streets and throw money to the citizens there. However, this was only the beginning of Antiochus IV's plan. Using his cunning, he visited Egypt's strongholds to find out their power. So in Daniel 11:25, it says, he shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. In 170 BC, when Antiochus IV felt secure about the state of his own kingdom, he decided to take Egypt by force in what came to be known as the Sixth Syrian War. He regarded Ptolemy VI as a weak ruler and therefore not capable of successfully waging war against him. Antiochus IV was able to move his army to the border of Egypt before he was met by the Egyptians at Pelusium, which is near the Nile Delta. The Egyptians had a large army arrayed against him there. Antiochus, risking death by riding into the midst of the Battle of Pelusium, ordered the Egyptians to be taken alive instead of slain. By this policy, he gained Pelusium and later took Memphis. Daniel 11:26. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. So Ptolemy VI's army, although large, was not able to withstand Antiochus IV. In large part, this was due to the intrigues of Antiochus IV, who corrupted several of the Egyptian ministers and officers. This was one of the main causes of the defeat of Ptolemy VI. Those who were in his confidant and possessed the secrets of the state betrayed him to Antiochus IV. For example, Ptolemy Macron, also called Ptolemy the son of Dorymenes, had been appointed by Ptolemy VI as governor of Cyprus. However, sensing the young king's weakness, he deserted to Antiochus IV, who made him governor of Cilicia, Syria, and Phoenicia. In verse 11:27, it says, both of these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. After he took control of Pelusium and Memphis, Antiochus IV set his sights on Alexandria. Due to the intrigues of Antiochus IV mentioned in verse 26, the Alexandrians had renounced their allegiance to Ptolemy VI and made his younger brother, Ptolemy VII, Euergetes, king in his place. While at Memphis, Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI had frequent conferences. Antiochus IV professed his great friendship to his nephew and concern for his interests, but his true plan was to weaken Egypt by setting the brothers against one another. Conversely, Ptolemy VI professed gratitude to his uncle for the interest he took in his affairs. He laid the blame of the war upon his minister, Eulaeus, one of the guardians appointed to watch over him after his father's death. All the while, Ptolemy VI sought to smooth over things with his brother, Ptolemy VII, so they could join forces against their deceitful uncle, Antiochus IV. Still with me? All right. Verse 11:28. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. So while Antiochus IV was engaged in Egypt, a false rumor arose in Judea that he had been killed. This prompted deposed high priest Jason to raise an army of 1,000 men and attack Jerusalem. His army captured the city and forced the high priest Menelaus to take refuge in the Acre fortress in Jerusalem. When news of the fighting in Jerusalem reached Antiochus IV, he took it to mean that Judea was in revolt against him. Antiochus IV left Egypt. On his way home, he and his armies marched against Jerusalem. He commanded his soldiers to kill everyone they encountered, like everyone, men, women, children, didn't matter. Within the space of 3 days, his forces had killed somewhere between 40 to 80,000 people. A similar number were captured and sold into slavery. Not satisfied with the slaughter, Antiochus IV entered the temple and, guided by Menelaus, took the holy vessels, including the golden altar, the menorah, the table for the showbread, the cups for drink offerings, the bowls, the gold censers, the curtains, the crowns, the gold decorations, and that were on the front of the temple. He took all the silver and gold, as well as the hidden treasures which he found. After appointing Phrygian Philip as governor in Jerusalem, Antiochus IV then returned to Antioch, because that's going to go well. Verse 11:29. At the appointed time, he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. So meanwhile, in Egypt, brothers Ptolemy VI and VII reconcile and agreed to share power. This annulled Antiochus IV's alliance with Ptolemy VI and caused his loss of control over the Ptolemaic kingdom. Because of this, in 168 BC, Antiochus IV once again sought to go to war against Egypt. However, this time, he would not have the same success as he achieved previously. Somebody's getting their comeuppance. Daniel 11:30, for ships from Cyprus shall come against him. Therefore, he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So because they knew they could not defeat Antiochus IV alone, the Ptolemy brothers appeared to Rome for help. In order to check the threat of Greek expansion, the Romans agreed to provide assistance. The ships from Kittim, or Cyprus, here refer to the ships which brought the Roman legions to Egypt in fulfillment of the defense pact. As Antiochus IV and his army marched towards Alexandria, they were met by three Roman senators led by Gaius Populi Linnaeus in Eleusis, a suburb of Alexandria. There, Roman ambassador Popilius delivered to Antiochus IV the Senate's demand that he withdraw from Egypt. When the king requested time for consultation, Popilius drew a circle around Antiochus IV with the stick he was carrying and told him not to leave the circle until he gave his response. The king in the north was astonished at this display of Roman arrogance, but after a brief time said he would do all that the Romans demanded. On his return to Syria, Antiochus IV tried to ease the sting of the humiliation he had suffered at the hands of the Romans by taking out his frustration on the Jews in Judea. His armies encircled Jerusalem and then attacked. All those Jews who resisted were executed. However, the pro-Hellenistic Jews who allied themselves with Antiochus IV were left unharmed. That was a mouthful. There's a lot of that here. I know. But we're towards the end, so stay with me. Daniel 11:31 says, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortresses. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. So Antiochus IV's army desecrated the temple and stopped the daily sacrifice. On the 15th of Kislev in December 168 BC, the Syrians built a pagan altar over the altar of burnt offerings in the temple and placed an image of Zeus Olympius upon it. 10 days later, on the 25th of Kislev, swine's flesh was offered on the altar to Zeus. Did you all just go, oh? because, yeah, that would be the abomination of desolation. On a religious thing, that is just disgusting. 11:32 says, "Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits." After venting his anger upon the Jews, desecrating the temple, Antiochus IV decreed that his entire kingdom should become one people, each giving up his own customs. The other peoples under his rule accepted Antiochus IV's command because of his flattering approach. Many of the people of Israel also forsook the law and adopted his religion. Antiochus IV commanded a change in all the ordinances of God. No sacrifices were to be offered in the sanctuary, the Sabbaths and feasts were to be profane, and that the Jews were not to circumcise their sons. Upon pain of death, they were commanded to profane the true religion so that eventually the law would be forgotten. Antiochus IV appointed inspectors to watch the Jews and commanded the cities of Judah to offer pagan sacrifices. Yet many in Israel stood firm and rejected the innovations of the king of the north. Daniel 11:33, "And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and flame, by captivity and plundering." So whenever Antiochus IV's men found copies of the Torah, they tore them to pieces and burned them. Whoever was found in possession of a Torah was put to death. According to Antiochus IV's decree, women who had their children circumcised were put to death, along with their entire families and those who had circumcised them. Still, many in Israel chose to die rather than to break the Holy Covenant. And you know that had to be tough, but I hope that I have that same resolve if it ever comes here. And I have no doubt it will. In Daniel 11:34, it says, "Now, when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join them by intrigue." As a historical book, 1 Maccabees shows the decrees of Antiochus IV eventually led to a rebellion started by the priest Mattathias and his five sons, including Judas Maccabee. He and his family had fled from Jerusalem to Modin when the Seleucid forces took the city. There, Mattathias killed a Jew who was sacrificing according to Antiochus IV's command, as well as the king's officer who was forcing them to sacrifice. From this first act of rebellion, a guerrilla war against the forces of Antiochus IV began. After the death of his father, Mattathias, in 167 BC, Judas Maccabee defeated the large army of Antiochus IV's general, Apollonius. This victory helped Judas gather a sizable force. However, only a minority of the soldiers were actually faithful men. Next, Siron, the commander of the Syrian army, came against the forces of Judas. His army was also defeated by Judas, and his fame spread all the way to Antioch. King Antiochus IV was greatly angered by the exploits of Judas and his men, and he gathered his army. He opened the royal treasury and gave his soldiers a year's wages, ordering them to be ready for whatever action needed to be taken. This approach quickly emptied the royal treasury of funds and made it necessary for Antiochus IV to seek additional tribute and spoil from his lands. In 166 BC, he decided to go to Persia to collect or seize by force the needed money. Antiochus IV left his general, Lysias, in charge of his son and half of his army with instructions to attack and destroy Jerusalem and Judea. Lysias sent an army of 40,000 infantry and 7,000 cavalry and marched into Judea. He met the forces of Judas Maccabee, 3,000 poorly equipped men, near Emmaus. However, despite being vastly outnumbered, Judas' army routed the Syrians, killing 3,000 and putting the rest to flight. In 165 BC, Lysias again sent the Syrian army, now numbering 60,000 infantrymen and 5,000 cavalry, against the Jewish forces, which had risen to 10,000. This time, 5,000 Syrians were killed, and Lysias fled back to Antioch. Because of his great victory, Judas and his men were able to recapture the temple. The pious Jews cleansed and renewed it, and on Kislev 25, 165 BC, 3 years to the day after the first abominable sacrifice had been offered, the new altar was rededicated and holy sacrifices offered. The Jews celebrated the rededication of the temple for 8 days. In memory of this Jewish victory and rededication of the temple, Judas Maccabee decreed that the feast of dedication, called Chanukah in Hebrew, was to be observed every year thereafter for 8 days, beginning on Kislev 25. In 164 BC, Antiochus IV's army was defeated at Elymais, Persia, when he attempted to plunder the city of its gold and silver. Soon thereafter, a messenger came from Antioch and notified him of the defeat of his armies by Judas and the Jews. Terribly shaken by these offenses, he fell sick and became bedridden. Antiochus IV died shortly after that. Daniel 11:35 says, "And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So when the Gentile nations around Judea heard of their victory over the Seleucids, they became very angry. They began to kill those Jews who lived among them. Judas Maccabee and his brother Simon went out to fight against those Gentiles who sought to kill the Jews and defeated them. After the death of Judas Maccabee in the battle in 161 BC, persecution continued upon the Jews, as history records. Many wicked Jews who opposed Judas and his goals took opportunity after his death to persecute and kill righteous Jews. Beginning with Mattathias's leadership of the rebellion against Antiochus IV, the rule of the Hasmoneans, named after Matthias's grandfather Asmoneus, lasted from 168 until 37 BC. The words "until the time of the end" refers to the end times, the second coming of Christ. The appointed time refers to the 70 weeks of years that Gabriel had earlier told Daniel about in 9:24 through 27, which led to the appearance of the Messiah. In Daniel 12, which continues from the end of 11, we are still talking about the end times. Michael, the archangel and the true opposite to Satan, as they are both angels and created by God, also the guardian of Israel, battle-wise. The time of trouble that Michael is standing up during is usually referred to as the Great Tribulation, which is so bad that the world has literally never been through it before. More details of how horrific it will be is found in Revelation 12, which we will dig more into once we get there, but that's not till the very end. Now, those that were asleep and are now awake refers to those who were dead and are now back to life with their body. And some will be in heaven as they believed in Christ, and those who don't will have everlasting contempt, which is hell. And the book goes on to describe those who will believe will have an incredible eternal life with God, and those who don't or didn't at the time of their death will have a horrific eternal hell. The angel then tells Daniel to keep his book safe and authenticate it. It is to be kept safe from many terrible leaders coming up, all the ones we just read. Then Daniel asks how long the tribulation will last and is given a time, times, and half a time, and thanks to other scripture is known to be 3.5 years. Daniel asks how it will all end, and he doesn't get a full answer, and neither do we, honestly, until much later when John writes the book of Revelation, but even then we don't know all. And thus ends the book of Daniel. And that was a lot of information. There's a lot to say. Again, I apologize for any mess ups in the pronunciation of things. I tried very hard, but that was a mouthful. This is where we're going to end today, or end this episode. If you have any reactions, thoughts, questions, or words you need to throw my way, please do so at my website, bmepodcast.com. Then episode B is already uploaded, so you can listen to that as well if you want, or if you want to give yourself a day to think over everything you just heard. Totally understandable, but have a most fabulous week, and I will see you for week 39. Bye.